So let's do this. Open back up to Hosea chapter 11 if you're still in Matthew. And you're more than welcome to take photos of me too while I preach, if that's okay. Yeah, thank you. Guys, every week we get the incredible privilege of gathering together, celebrating our God, and actually hearing Him speak through His Word so we actually get to know Him better. And the brilliant thing is we've got a God who wants us to know Him. There's something about our knowledge of Him that's always going to be limited. You know, Isaiah 55, as high as the heavens are above the earth, His thoughts are so much greater than ours, His mind so much greater than ours. There's always going to be things that we're not going to be able to comprehend about our God. And yet, He's a God who actually wants us to know what He's like. And so He goes out of His way to make Himself known to us. Now, I'll tell you what, the book of Hosea is really helpful in that regard. God gives us pictures and He tells stories to help us understand what He's like. Actually, even more, to help us try and feel what He feels. And we've got some more of that again tonight. Our God is accommodating. That's one word you could use. He uses human images and language to help us understand. Right at the beginning of Hosea, you know, the image that's used is God saying, I'm like a husband. I'm like a husband who takes an unfaithful, adulterous wife to myself. That's kind of what it's like for me to be your God. It's pretty heavy as God's people to hear Him describe that relationship, particularly with Israel. Tonight we get a slightly different human image, but again, it's a wonderful window into the heart of God that you can get a glimpse at least into what it feels like for God to have us as His people. What He's going to do for us tonight, He's going to say this. He's going to say, I'm like a man and I'm not like a man. Those two things, all right? I'm like a man in this sense. The first thing we get the picture there is He says, I'm like a father towards you. You know, earlier in Hosea, He's like, I'm a husband, you're my wife. Now we get to this point and the picture is, no, I'm like a father and you are my son. But as He describes to us the kind of father that He is, we get to delight in who He is because He's the best father you can imagine. You know, He's one of those dads. None of us had one perfectly like this, but He's the dad that's just super involved. He's attentive. He's affectionate. He's adoring. He's protective. He's loving in His training and discipline of us as His children. He's everything you'd ever want in a father. He's the perfect father. And He actually says to His people, Old Testament people, Israel, He says, you're my son. He actually says it explicitly like that in Exodus chapter 4. Israel, He says, Israel is my firstborn son. That's the way He describes His people in the Old Testament. My firstborn son. Firstborn meaning you guys are going to be the one that inherit all my blessings. Because that's what the firstborn son gets in the ancient world. So you're going to inherit everything. You're going to get the land and you're going to get all the blessing. And that's the actual image that we get right there in verse 1 of chapter 11 there in Hosea, where God as the Father is speaking about Israel like they are His son. Pick it up there with me. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. It's beautiful, isn't it? Israel, he was like a child, and I loved him. That's God's initiative. He's like, I'm going to take a child to myself, and it's going to be out of love that I do it. That's why I do it. That's why I get a people for myself. It's my love. And it's out of Egypt, I called my son, which helps you conjure up the concept of when God's people were brought out of slavery in Egypt, and when God did that, when He rescued them out of slavery and he took them and He gathered them at Mount Sinai, it's almost like His son was being born. That's the imagery we're meant to have. As God rescues His people and gathers them to Himself and steps into a covenant relationship with His people at Mount Sinai, it's like His son is being born, and that's the imagery we get there. He's like, out of Egypt, I called you my son. It's like you were born and you were delivered, and now I'm going to call you mine. In love, I've rescued you from slavery. I've gathered you, and now my son is born, and I'm going to name it mine. You will be my people, and I will be your God. When you get to Exodus chapter 19, verses 3 through to 8, you know, you get the agreement that gets set up where God's saying, here's what I've done. I've brought you to myself, and you're to live this way as mine, and I'm going to continue to love you. The imagery that's kind of conjured up here is the father that, like, has a son born into his arms. and then brings that son to his chest. You ever seen that image before? Maybe you're a father who's been able to do that. One of my mates just recently had his first kid, and he posted a picture on Instagram this week, and it was that picture of the fresh baby, washed, clean, but just no clothes or anything, and just on his bare chest. You know that whole skin-to-skin bonding thing? Pretty good. Right? He's just got this picture of him with his baby on it. It's just beautiful. And that's the imagery we're meant to get here. God catches, you know, sees his son delivered, and he takes his son Israel to himself, and he puts him on his chest, and he goes, "You're mine. I'm going to give you my name, and I'm going to hold you, and I'm going to love you." This is the relationship God has with his people. And he doesn't do it because they're impressive, and he doesn't do it because they're lovable. God is the one who loves the loveless. That's what Hosea is all about. We read on, not only does God actually give his people life and love, he then raises his people like he would raise a young child. And the imagery here is excellent, isn't it? If you've been in this week, you would have been loving this with me. Look at verse 3. He says, "It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms. They did not realize, but it was I who healed them." So you got the picture there, haven't you? It's like a father teaches a young child to take its first few steps. Have you ever had the chance to do that with a kid? You're squatting down and you're holding it by the arms and you're saying, "Come on, come on," and you're walking backwards while it walks forward and you're down on its level. It's such a precious moment. Whether you've done it with someone else's kid or yours, there's like you're staring into each other's faces, you're giggling your heads off, the smiling, the celebrating. This is what God does with his people. He teaches them to walk, and really the first few steps that God's people Israel get to take is being taught how to follow him. As they're given the guidelines, the commandments about how to live and honor their God at Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments and the rest of the law, it's like, here's how you're to walk. It's a beautiful way to walk. And that's, isn't it a gorgeous picture that he pull him along like that? And then, of course, I don't know if you remembered ever doing that. And then you're like, this kid's got it. And you let go and you step back and the kid takes one or two steps and then just goes flat on its face in front of you and cries. And then this concept of, "I'm the one that healed them too." I don't know, the imagery, I think it's like when you fell, I was the one that picked you up. I comforted you. I kissed your whatever hurt. And like, you know, this is the tenderness of a God towards his people. This is our God. Verse 4, the imagery kind of rolls on. "I led them with cords of human kindness, with ties of love. To them, I was like one who lifts a little child to the cheek. I bent down to feed them." Like, this is incredible imagery. Some people think this kind of cords of human kindness is the concept of, in the ancient world, they'd wear long things and aprons, and often there were these cords or tassels that would come off the aprons. And the way that a young child would stay in the safety zone of the parent is you just hang onto those tassels and you just follow them around, you know, because you're safe as long as you're hanging onto one of those cords. It might be conjuring up that kind of image. These days, we don't have cords, but you imagine a kid that's just kind of, you know, hugging the legs of its parent, you know, right underneath those legs. That's the safety zone, kind of. But that's the place where you want to be as a kid. And then the image, like, it goes on. It's like, "To them I was like one who lifts a little child to the cheek." So it's the child that you don't just tower over, but you bend down, you pick them up and you bring them up to you and you kiss their cheek. You know the smell of little babies? They're so good, you know. You just want to kiss me, you want to eat them. You know, this is God. He's just got such affection towards his people. He bends down to feed them. All this is imagery of what God did initially with his people, teaching them to walk. You know, when they went out into the wilderness, what did God do? Well, he provided for them. He brought water out of a rock. He brought manna. He brought quail. He fed them. He literally fed them. He guided them along the way. When they fell and tripped up, he was the one to comfort them with tender affection. It's beautiful imagery of what God has done with these people. He's been like the best father to have a child born and call them his own and then actually raise them, teach them to walk. It's gorgeous. I mean, he's loved them, he's protected them, he's provided for them like the best father you can imagine. And how does Israel, the son that's been so loved and cared for, respond to the father who's lavished them with that kind of love and protection? Here's where we get the opportunity, if you'll take it, to feel some of the devastation that God would feel after lavishing so much love and protection on a son. Have a look at how Israel, the son, responds. Tragically, Israel turns away in stubborn rebellion. You see it there in verse 2. But the more they were called, the more they went away from me. You know, the picture is that child that's kind of running in the wrong direction, and the father or the parent is calling out to the child and saying, hey, come back, don't run there, don't go on the road, don't do that. But the more he calls, the more the child runs. Have you ever had that as a parent? You know, the kid just doing the opposite of what you're saying. This is how God feels. The more he's called out to his people, the further they run away. And where are they running? Well, it tells you what they're doing, and they're running. It's worse than running across a busy road. They sacrificed to Baals, and they burned incense to images. So they're going after other gods, wanting to acknowledge those other gods as the ones who gave them life and sustained them and worthy of all their worship. And these other gods are not even gods at all. They're false gods. They're just statues. There's no life in them. They can't give life. And yet God's son, Israel, is actually going and worshipping them. Look at verse 3. He says, it was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms, but they did not realize it was I who healed them. It was I who saved them. Likely going back to that original image of saving them out of Egypt, the classic Old Testament salvation event. It's like they forgot immediately that I was the one who rescued them. I was the one who brought the 10 plagues upon Egypt to actually release them. I was the one who dried up the Red Sea that they could walk across. I was the one. It's like they just forgot. They forgot what I'd done for them. Can you feel a father's pain here? Can you feel what it would be like to be a father who's raised a son in love only to have that son or child turn away from you, disregard you, reject you, live like you didn't exist? Maybe some of you don't actually need to imagine what that's like, because you're like, oh, that's kind of what I copped when my kids went through teenage years. It was heavy. It still is heavy. I don't know. It's tricky for many, many parents. But just catch this on the way through. Our God has emotions. Our God feels pain and anguish. Our God is personally impacted by our sin. He's not just this heavenly policeman who's just sitting up there getting grumpy, trying to get us to do all the right things. If that's your picture of God, it's not the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible is a father who is affected by how we believe. He's a father who's how we walk. He's a father who's up close and personal, and he grieves the sin of his wayward children. Can you feel his pain? And as a side note, if this is what our God is like, if he's a God who feels emotions, then you can know this for sure. God can handle your emotions. God can handle your pain and your anguish. You can bring them to him. He can have compassion on you, understanding on you. He's able to comfort you in those situations. Our God's the one who came up with the idea of emotions. So you can bring them to him. But think about God for a minute. The pain is real. The offense towards him is real. The break in the covenant agreement is real, and so the consequences have to be real as well. There needs to be discipline. There needs to be judgment of a loving father on his son who's gone wayward like this, and that's what we get in verse 5. It kind of turns, and we hear a bit about the judgment that God's actually going to hand out to his people for the way they've treated him. Have a look at it there with me, verse 5. Will they not return to Egypt, and will not Assyria rule over them because they refuse to repent? So God's people, just they don't want to turn, they don't want to change, and so God's saying, you know what's going to happen? You know, it's like they're going to go back to Egypt. What does it say? Will not Assyria rule over them? You know, that's just God saying, I'll tell you what's going to happen. Here's the way I'm actually going to discipline my people. I'm actually going to bring a pagan nation from the north called Assyria to actually come down. And within 50 years, this is exactly what happens. They invade the northern kingdom of Israel. They pretty much obliterate the place. And they carry off most of the people back up into Assyria, and so that they would assimilate and scatter them among the people. They do it, you know, it goes on. The swords will flash in the cities. It will devour the false prophets. It's heavy. It's heavy that God's people get invaded and they get destroyed and they get cut up and they get carried off and they're gone. Almost absolute destruction. Now, how do you feel about that? Because whenever you open up one of the Old Testament books of prophecy, we're going to come across judgment. And sometimes chapter after chapter after chapter of judgment. Hosea gives us stacks of mercy and grace, but you go to some of the other prophetic books and there's a whole lot. How do you feel when you hear about God judging his people? And you're allowed to feel how you feel. And I just want to ask you that question, because it might be that you read this kind of stuff and think, well, it's a bit heavy. It's a bit strong. Does God really need to pour out that kind of judgment? That's pretty serious. A nation comes in and goes to war against you and obliterates you. You know, do you ever find yourself thinking, do they really deserve that? Well, if you do, if you find yourself sometimes thinking, oh, wow, that's a bit harsh, God, I'll tell you why I think it probably is. I think it's probably because you've got a sanitized view of their sin. Yeah? Because when you dig into the details of what it actually looked like for them to go and worship other gods, it's hectic. It's horrendous. It's so offensive to God as their father, and it's so destructive to them as a community. It's a terrible way to live. And I tell you what, if you're in your group this week and you actually looked at this passage and you went back and looked at chapter 9 and 10, you know, and you get and Hosea's kind of mentioning a number of things that have happened in the past in certain places like Baal Peor and Gibeah, and you went back and kind of dug into kind of Judges and Numbers and saw what actually happened back there, it's hectic. What God's people got up to, I'll just give you a little glimpse of it in case you don't know what I'm talking about here. To go after false gods and foreign gods actually meant they needed to step into a level of sexual immorality that was just completely perverse. And they did. And it ended up being so destructive to them and their families. You get to the account of Judges 19, and what's happened for them as they've gone after these foreign gods and committed really horrendous forms of sexual immorality, it kind of seems to have just inflamed so much unholy desires in them that the whole culture of Israel has just become frightening. Really a frightening place to live. So when you get to Judges 19, you get that horrendous incident of that woman who's gang raped in the city square and then dies because of the injuries that she suffers. And if that's not horrendous enough, the men who did that to her, like the whole city of men after the incident, stand by their behavior, don't see the problem, want to defend their actions. So debauched is the culture now among Israel, and particularly in this tribe of Benjamin. And the thing is, this isn't just an isolated incident. This has actually become characteristic of Israel in that time. I mean, have a look at verse 7 here in chapter 11, where God says, "My people are determined to turn from me." It's not like this just happened once in one generation. This just happened again and again and again. It was systematic. They didn't just have a bad day or a bad week or a bad month. This is ongoing, unrepentant sin that's widespread, and it's generational, and it's horrific. And when you see it for what it is, and you dig into the details, you tell me, do they deserve judgment? I mean, we all say absolutely. I mean, in our society, when someone commits a kind of horrendous act like that, you know, we have life in prison or the death penalty. It's not a time for mercy. It's just a time to kind of pour out judgment. And in fact, we find it, we're fascinated why people would even do those kind of horrendous crimes that the whole of Israel seemed to think was fine. We're so fascinated by it that we do documentaries on why serial killers and people who commit these kind of murders, you know, what happened for them. That, you know, there's always documentaries on Netflix about this. And often what it does, it kind of traces back to find out what happened for that person. It traces back into their childhood. And typically what they find in the childhood is just super traumatic, abusive experience, which has just really kind of messed them up, which kind of somewhat explains why they'd go and do these kind of horrendous things. But you know occasionally what they find? They dig back through the history of someone who commits this kind of crime, and they go back to their childhood, and they find out that they were raised by really loving, caring, beautiful parents. And we're absolutely baffled, because it's almost extra tragic that you can raise a child so beautifully well and then they turn so terribly bad. That's Israel. That's God's people. Showered with love from day one. Tenderness, affection, but they go so bad. They go so bad. So what should God do? Well, God should punish. God should judge. God should discipline. Yeah? God should, some would say, destroy, put an end to them. But here's where God goes, listen up, I'm like a man, but I'm not like a man. In other words, I'm kind of like, the way you think and feel about judgment and that, yeah, but there's something else going on for me. Have a look at it. This. Check it out. Here's where we get to see deep into the heart of God. Look at verse 9, the second half of verse 9. Look what he says. For I am God and not a man, the Holy One among you. I will not come against their cities. Now, this is interesting. God says, you know, he's kind of enticing us to understand what judgment looks like. And then he goes, but I tell you what, I'm God, not like you. So listen up. Now, that is likely a, I'm God, not a man, is likely a shorthand quote of the longer version that you get back in Numbers chapter 23 that goes like this. God is not a man that he would lie. He's not a man that he would change his mind. That's what humans do. Humans change their mind and they lie, but God is not like that. He does not change. And so the point is this, God is going to stick to what he said he would do in this regard. And really, in this regard, God is the one who recalls what he committed to doing way back in the past. And he says, I've made a commitment and it's in line with my character and I'm going to fulfill it. I promised long ago that these people would be mine forever. And so, I cannot go against my promise. I cannot go against my character that poured out love on them right there in the beginning and made promises to them. And if you go back to the original promise in Genesis chapter 12 made to Abraham, God is the one who says to his people, you're going to be my people, you're going to bear my name, you're going to be numerous, I'm going to bless you, and you're going to be a blessing to all the nations. And God says, I can't go back on my promise. My people deserve to be judged, and some would say wiped out altogether, but I've made a promise. And I made that promise out of my love, out of my tenderness. I am a judge, and I will bring judgment, but I am also perfect love and mercy, and so I have to withhold the full extent of my fierce anger here. I will be gracious. I will show mercy because I'm God and I'm not a man. And my ability to show mercy is like nothing you've ever felt or experienced, but I'm God. I will not act out of character. I will treat them based on my holy character. I'm the Holy One among you. And so I will not treat you based on how you've treated me. I will treat you based on my holy character and the promises that I've made towards you out of my holy character. Sometimes when we're trying to understand the judgment of God and what humanity deserves, we say things like this. We kind of say, can you see what God's people deserved? And you know, what God could have done, what he should have done was actually just wipe them out completely. I'm not sure about that. God certainly could have. He's all powerful. He could wipe his people out completely. But should he wipe his people out completely? Because I actually don't think God can or would, because it would be out of line with his character to actually not show mercy and not fulfill a promise that he's made to have his people as his own forever. He's not just a just judge. He is the lover of his people. And you're never going to shake off his love. I'm not a man, he says. Humans have limits to their mercy. I'm holy, not human. And so in the midst of announcing this judgment, there's a flick of a switch almost in this passage at verse 8. Have a look at it there with me. Something happens for God here. It's like a tone change. It's a breath of fresh air in the midst of announcing the judgment that he's going to pour out. Look at he says, how can I give up on you, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel? How can I treat you like Admah? How can I make you like Zeboiim? Now, Admah and Zeboiim, there are a couple of cities in the region of Sodom and Gomorrah. Back in the time when God actually rained down burning sulfur and completely annihilated everyone in those cities. And God said, how can I do that to my people? How can I do that to you? How can I annihilate you? How can I give you up? I can't, is his answer. I can't give up on you. Verse 9, I will not carry out my fierce anger, nor will I devastate Ephraim again, for I'm God, not a man, the Holy One among you. I will not come against my cities. I can't do it. And why can't he do it? Because God is not simply a just judge. He is also, and here's what overwhelms his judgment on his people, God is loving and merciful. Look at the second half of verse 8. My heart is changed within me. All my compassion is aroused. It's almost like God has got conflict within him because of the complexity of his character. It's right for him to feel fierce wrath and anger towards his people, to judge them for their sin. But at the very same time, what happens for him here is his heart is changed. It's like his heart recoils. It turns back the fierce anger. And what overwhelms instead of fierce anger, what wells up in him is compassion. And it's not someone else coming along and changing God and changing the way he feels towards his people. It's come from within him. It emerges out of his own character. He grows warm and tender towards his people. His compassion is aroused. It swells up. It overwhelms his just wrath. And it overflows. And it's beautiful. God's mercy towards his people has no limits. He's able to be merciful like you and I can never be merciful. His compassion can just cover over all. Back in chapter 10, it's spoken of in this way. His love is unfailing. His righteousness is just showered over us. But how is that the case? How is it that God can actually be right in holding back judgment and actually pouring out mercy? Well, it's because he actually does pour out his judgment on someone else in their place and in our place. It's Jesus. This is why we celebrate Jesus. Because Jesus is the true Son. He's the perfect Son. He's the one who's the substitute for Israel and us. He's the one, look at it, it says it there in verse 1. Come back to verse 1. Did you notice that? Out of Egypt I called my son. Now he's speaking there about Israel, but then we read in Matthew chapter 2. Did you catch that reading in Matthew chapter 2? We did this in the Matthew series at the beginning of the year, which just continually quotes Old Testament in Matthew. This quote, this verse, Matthew 2 quotes Hosea chapter 11 to actually be saying that this is actually about Jesus. Out of Egypt I called my son. So Jesus as a young child was taken into Egypt and then was called back out of Egypt. Jesus is the one who actually is the true Son. He's the one who comes and lives the perfect life on behalf of Israel, the life Israel could never live. And he dies a death in their place and in our place. He's the Son that Israel could never be. He's the representative for us because we can't be the perfect Son either. Jesus is the true Israel. And it's in Jesus that God's mercy calls us back. And look at verse 10 and 11. It's just, you've got more imagery here. It kind of flicks from the concept of God being Father to now God's a lion. Bring that on, eh? He's a lion and he roars. Look at verse 10. They, that's the God's people who are called back, they will follow the Lord. He will roar like a lion. And when he roars, his children will come trembling from the west. They will come from Egypt, trembling like sparrows, from Assyria, fluttering like doves. I will settle them in their homes, declares the Lord. So here's what God's going to do. He's going to punish them, and they are going to be carried off into exile, up into Assyria. But then there's going to be a moment where God brings them back, which basically never happens in history. Once you've been taken off into a foreign nation and assimilate, you never get to go back to your land, but not God's people. He loves them. He's made a commitment to them. He's going to bring them back out of Assyria. He's going to bring them back out of Egypt. When later on, the southern kingdom gets carried off that way. He's going to bring them all back, and he's going to do it like with the roar of a lion. He's going to call them back in mercy. And the ones who are his children will hear the roar, and they'll come trembling, fluttering. It's really humbling imagery, isn't it, to come trembling back because you hear the roar of God's voice. And it's actually the roar of his mercy. And you come trembling back home. The imagery of a lion here is just perfect, isn't it? Because ultimately, God's mercy goes out to the world through Jesus. And we know Jesus, the imagery that's used for Jesus is that he's the lion of the tribe of Judah. Yeah? He's slain like a lamb on the cross and bears our sin, but then he rises again from the dead and roars like a lion, declaring the victory of God and roaring out the mercy of God to everyone on earth. And I don't know what you hear when you've heard of Jesus, but I tell you what, you hear the roar of the lion of the tribe of Judah, and you can do one of two things. You can either hear the call and hear it as mercy and come trembling back before God, or you can hear it and run. When you hear the lion roar, through Jesus, God roars to our earth, and he roars tonight, come back, my child, follow me. Have you heard the roar? I know so many of you have. Have you heard the roar, and have you seen the mercy of God? Have you recognized the incredible love of God, our Father? Have you come trembling and fluttering home, back into the safety of the mercy of the Father's arms, humble as a child, back into the tender love of God to follow him faithfully as a child? Can you see the incredible love of our God here? Let me pray. Father, thank you for your word to us tonight. Thank you for this book of Hosea. Thank you for the images that you use to help us understand you. The loving husband, the loving father, the lion that roars mercy and calls us home. Father, we want to know you better and better. We want our lives to come alive in your love. We want to celebrate your goodness to us. We want to follow you and bring glory to you. Please, Lord, keep doing that work in us by your Spirit for your name's sake. Amen.